Honorable members, my right to note that a quorum is 6. 30% of 17 is 5.1. We rounded up to 6. Keep that in mind, because if ever there are around 6 members in the chamber, we don't have a quorum. The Honorable Arbiter. Mr. Speaker, on the right, because we have a quorum, albeit marginal, and I'm sure some of my colleagues in this House and one from the Eye will join us in the coming moment. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to present my third budget address in relation to the areas that form part of our ministerial responsibilities in what is our government's fifth budget since the general election of December 2011 and first since last year's election. Speaker, the vote to leave the European Union on the 23rd of June has led to the greatest period of political uncertainty in my lifetime. The firms and businesses in Gibraltar had in my mind responded to this uncertainty in the manner that I would expect, with a calm and professional period of reflection of the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead. The one overriding feature of this process is that there is time. Time to consider the options, time to consider the challenges and time to consider the opportunities. And this is absolutely necessary, as until we understand the direction of travel, it will not be possible to plan with any degree of certainty. But of course, I'm not suggesting that we do nothing. On the contrary, there are many things that we need to be thinking about and working together to achieve, which I will detail later in my address. Now more than ever, Mr. Speaker, our private sector and, of course, government need to work closely and quietly together in preparing ourselves to be best placed in the coming months and years. And now that a battered Europe strives to stabilise and cope with the many challenges ahead, I am quietly confident, it is my way, that Project Gibraltar will continue to benefit from the very fine efforts and significant inroads made by this administration on all fronts, I might add, since its effect in 2011. Moving on, Mr. Speaker, my message is simple. Gibraltar is open for business as usual, but there is much work to be done. That said, Mr. Speaker, I start by congratulating the Gibraltar National Bank for making a complete success of its first year in operation. Since it opened last year, the bank, led by Lawrence Barista and Derek Fennell, the staff, and the board of directors, have worked tirelessly and deserve the congratulations and thanks of this House and of the community for the fantastic start the bank has made in its first 12 months of operation. Over 7,000 accounts have been opened, over 244 million in deposits, and an increasing loan book with some 450 mortgages is a testament to the work of the team at GIB. Many at the time spoke of the doom and gloom at the departure of Barclays in late 2013, and yet today it is a distant memory, with a seamless transition to this modern, innovative, and digital bank. There is, of course, still work to be done, but I believe that the target date for break-even and profitability after 3 years trading will be met. As we speak, we are working on new areas in terms of products and functions, including, of course, mobile banking, which I much look forward to seeing in operation. My sincere thanks to Lawrence, Derek, the board of directors, and, of course, the staff of the bank, for their professional commitment in delivering the quality and service we are serving. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister Clinton mentioned in his intervention that we had told him to go and get it for himself in referring to the account of the bank. I think they're mentioning a little bit unkind, and I know he likes to dress himself up in this Rumpelesque caricature, with perhaps not sufficient of the humour that Rumpel enjoys. But what we did say was that, as indeed with every other member of our community, the accounts will be filed in the company's house and will be available not just to the honourable member, but of course to every single member of our community. Mr. Speaker, in the area of financial services, we have introduced significant legislation this last year to further support the sector, and we continue with our efforts to attract new business to Gibraltar. We believe more than ever that it is right to continue working on improving the legal and regulatory framework to enhance and develop the business environment across the whole of the sector. I am most grateful to the Finance Centre Council and the individual associations we should be frequently linked for their continued support and cooperation on all matters. As a matter of practice, we now share with the relevant association any changes being contemplated in our legislation, including EU legislation, and work with them to ensure the provisions meet with our expectations. I must also thank the associations, in particular the technical committee, for their support and valuable advice in these areas. Mr. Speaker, it is critical that we are all on the same page in this process. In the field of private client work, senior executive for the Senator has all but completed a legislative review process, bringing to Parliament a wide range of legislation arising from the request by STEP some 8 years ago. The final piece of this particular good score, private foundations, will come before Parliament during this session. Once again, I'm very pleased to recognise the significant contribution to this process by the private sector members, and in particular by STEP, who have been at the forefront of this initiative. We have already seen international firms providing Gibraltar with four solutions to their clients' needs using these new products. The promotion of new opportunities created by this legislation remains a priority and continues to feature in our chosen international jurisdiction. In terms of our business development, we pursue our business plan in partnership with the sector, and interestingly this year, have widened the traditional geographical spread to include Leeds, Birmingham, Manchester, Edinburgh, and Bristol. Of course, Mr. Speaker, London and Switzerland also feature heavily in this programme, and last year spent some 24 weeks on the road promoting Gibraltar. It's interesting, Mr. Speaker, as an aside, that all of these jurisdictions which we focused on at the beginning of this year are focusing more on the regions of the UK and not just London itself, something that may become more important in the months and years ahead, depending on what transpires as a result of the vote of the 23rd of June. We advised last year the desire to increase the focus on family office businesses. I'm pleased to say that we have seen some tangible results in this regard, which has impacted positively on a number of our key private sector areas. We continue to give this area our full attention and will work this year in addition with the philanthropy forum in further delivering possibilities in this area. We have also driven the particular with private sector professionals with a review of virtual currencies. In fact, Mr. Speaker, we have consulted twice on this process. The remit has been widened to include into area fintech, an economic industry composed of companies that use technology to make financial services more efficient. We are happy to embrace this development as long as we are able to regulate effectively in this area and preserve and protect our reputation as a leading international financial services centre. This method of doing business has been gaining significant international acceptance and plays to the particular strength of Gibraltar. There have been specific expressions of interest from external investors with a view to creating a hub in Gibraltar, and I hope to announce some exciting news in this area in the coming weeks. I must also at this stage thank the CEO of the Financial Services Commission, Samantha Barrett, the board and team of the FSC that I worked this year. It has been a busy one, dealing with new legislation, directives, the fee funding review, and the continuous work to be more efficient and effective. I must also congratulate them on the creation of a change and innovation team at the FSC. An acceptance and an important one, in my view, Mr. Speaker, by the regulator that businesses need to innovate to remain competitive and profitable. The industry has welcomed this move, and so do I. The sector will also be pleased to learn that the FSC has immediately, after the EU vote, added additional resources to the authorisation team to ensure that we are faster than we ever have been in considering quality applications from new firms. Mr. Speaker, our Category 2 and health products continue to provide effective solutions and are attractive to the international client. The uncertainty created with the review of the UK's resident non-domicile rules provides further opportunity in this space, and specific marketing is taking place. As the Chief Minister has announced, I will shortly reconvene the working group to further consider their proposals and to also consider a new allowance-based system to support key people living and working in Gibraltar. We also continue to grow our social media presence, Mr. Speaker, as a method of increasing awareness to a wide yet appropriate audience. Our database stands in excess of 4,800 individuals, where we interact with almost on a daily basis. Our electronic bookshelf now has 129 publications, up 39 in last year, covering the full range of topics that are of interest to our readers. It's interesting to speak of it to date. These publications have been read in excess of 9,000 times. During the year, Mr. Speaker, our banking sector has welcomed the addition of Moneypool, one of the UK's fastest growing foreign exchange companies, to our list of licensed banks. We welcome them to Gibraltar in their successful establishment of this specialist firm. Mr. Speaker, in the area of insurance and pensions, my council is continuing its drive to improve our product range and develop new and interesting possibilities in this space. The introduction of Solvency II in January this year increases the capital requirements for insurance companies, and in turn, this makes it harder for smaller start-up insurers. As a result, we believe there is an opportunity to attract more managing general agents, or MGAs as they're known, to the Gibraltar. MGAs underwrite business using the underwriting authority of a separate insurer, e.g. the use an insurance company's paper. A number of new MGAs have been established in Gibraltar, and we have seen quite some interest in this area. The compelling reason to establish an insurance company in Gibraltar applies equally to MGAs, and we are keen to increase the number of these operating from here. In the field of Part 7 transfers, I mentioned last year, Mr. Speaker, that we had hoped to have initiated our first Part 7 transfer in the UK Gibraltar during 2015. I'm pleased to report that an application for such a transfer was initiated in late 2015 and is currently being reviewed by both the PRA and the FCA in the United Kingdom. We have continued our dialogue with the insurance team at HM Treasury in London, who have a particular interest in this test case, and remain both supportive and positive that a Part 7 transfer can take place under the UK's existing legislation. We hope that the regulatory review will be completed shortly, allowing the lawyers to apply for a hearing in the High Court in London. We continue to maintain a regular dialogue with the legacy insurance sector because we are aware of the progress being made. Mr. Speaker, as regards our letters, the IRS transaction that was completed in April 2015 is, as we understand, being renewed and should be announced shortly. The major effort during the second half of 2015 was the initiative begun by the Board of Finance and later supported by a number of businesses from the IRS sector, led by Gibraltar Lloyds and the FSC to create a new class of protected sale company, a special purpose vehicle protected sale company. We announced this in November 2015 and it has been well received. The EU referendum has acted in effect as a brake on some of these insurance company applications, and likewise the IRS sector is also waiting to drop from the vote before taking any decision on establishing new structures in Gibraltar. I can say, Mr. Speaker, that we remain in close contact with these firms and are hopeful that more will follow shortly. Mr. Speaker, the new personal pensions regulations have been drafted and will be shared with the pension sector within the next few weeks. The regulations could come into force in early September 2016. A positive dialogue has been ongoing with both HMRC and HM Treasury in London. We seek to ensure that the regulations will satisfy HMRC's requirements with respect to imported pensions and HM Treasury as we look to introduce greater flexibility for capital withdrawals from imported pensions in a similar manner to those introduced within the UK in April of 2015. The new regulations will both widen and enhance the existing regulatory framework and will also permit greater use of contract-based pension schemes, including, for the first time, the use of protective sale companies for pensioners. In funds, Mr. Speaker, we have continued to work closely with JIFIA in all of our efforts to develop our product range and market the Gibraltar proposition. I am most grateful to them for their commitment and assistance in supporting our efforts. We have worked on a number of significant initiatives in terms of our business development, including our Gibraltar events in Zurich, Geneva, Singapore, Hong Kong, and, of course, London. We will continue with these efforts and are in regular contact with JIFIA to understand and agree with our priorities. I must also mention the Gibraltar Stock Exchange, who continue to grow from strength to strength and are a catalyst for the further development of this important sector. I understand that significant new business will be undertaken by GSX in the coming months, and I look forward to reporting further on these. Our acceptance to money value, which will be carrying out the evaluation to vote in 2018, is a further example of our commitment to meeting and complying with international standards. I am grateful to both the public and private sectors for their work in preparing for this evaluation, as well, of course, as to David Perodi for driving this project forward. We are finalising our arrangements for the Central Registry's beneficial ownership, which has been delayed as a result of the changes proposed to the corporation by the UK and the five EU countries that are driving the new pilot scheme. I would expect the registry to be operational by the end of the year in advance of the June 2017 required date. Mr. Speaker, before turning to voting, I must thank Mr. Jimmy Clifford, our Chief Executive, and his fantastic team at Gibraltar Finance, for the superb work done this last year. It has been a busy year, and I fully expect this coming year to be at least as busy as well. Jimmy is a consummate professional, always calm, but always a step ahead of the issue in hand, and of course, a pleasure to work with. I must also thank the Finance Centre Council and participating associations for their continued support and interaction, which is below I greatly welcome and value. I look forward to working further with them in the coming year. Mr. Speaker, in gaming, the vote of continued success in the development and delivery of remote gambling is something we remain very proud of. It is an industry characterized by higher levels of change and uncertainty than many others. The industry has faced strong headwinds in the last 4 or 5 years, with numerous new national licensing regimes, new regulations, and additional taxation by other states rapidly becoming the new norm. Nevertheless, Mr. Speaker, the industry has continued to grow and deepen its roots here in Gibraltar. I can only pay tribute to the owners, managers, and employees of our licensees who have shown such resilience and commitment to Gibraltar. Likewise, Bill Breer, our hugely experienced and internationally respected gambling commissioner, and his staff, work incredibly hard to support our licensees and ensure operators of the right calibre are aware that we are keen to have them licensed and located here in Gibraltar. I cannot underestimate the importance of Mr. Breer's work in these areas, and I am delighted to acknowledge and thank him for his knowledge and expertise in everything he does for us. I fully understand and appreciate how fortunate we are to have him. It remains the case that at any one time, a series of discussions are taking place between my staff and a handful of parties interested in being licensed in Gibraltar. As an aside, I would say, Mr. Speaker, that only this morning I received an email from one such prospect. The list is not endless, and it is getting shorter, but it is never the intention of the government to open the floodgates, and we do not intend to do so now. Quality will always prevail over quantity. The year April 2015 to March 2016 has seen the addition of 3 new licensees. These have in part cancelled out the 5 licenses left or consolidated through the international trend of mergers and acquisitions in the industry. That said, a further 3 licensees have been added since just April 2016. So the total number of licensees continues to grow, 31 as of the 21st of March, 34 as of the 31st of May. Busy as they are, Mr. Speaker, the gambling division also incorporated licensing into Gibraltar slot machines and bookmaker premises into their offices this year. Members will know that land-based gambling offices of this type are commonplace throughout Europe and the rest of the world. In different forms and with an increased sophistication and value, it is important more than ever that all our land-based services meet standards applied internationally. Members will recall that last year the government commissioned were proved to be a far more substantial review of the remote elements of the Gambling Act of 2005 by 4 of the greatest most experienced lawyers in the sector. I was very pleased to be able to circulate my report to the industry at the end of April 2016. I have recently written to the industry, inviting them to meet on a one-to-one basis so that the government can properly identify the industry's own views and expectations in this area and help us develop a comprehensive framework for a full revision of the 2005 Act into 2017. I would not emphasize the importance of finding the right balance for the legislation as it underpins the licensing and regulation of this industry in an ever-changing global licensing and regulatory environment. and with equally fast-moving technology, organizational, and ownership changes. It remains our ambition that legislation that has served us so well for the last 10 years is replaced by legislation that is equally, if not more, effective in supporting the sector through future decades. Mr. Speaker, as I informed members last year, it remains the case that the GBGA position will be challenged to the UK's point of consumption tax is yet to be concluded. The case has been referred to the UK Court of Justice, and the court's own processes have been initiated and may soon come to fruition. It goes without saying that until this case is determined, it is not practical for the government to proceed with its own plans to review the current regime for revenue fees, charges, duties, and taxes. Whilst we remain totally committed to the highest standards of consumer protection, the industry cannot compete and thrive if every jurisdiction is taxed, treated as some form of cash power. The government hopes to be able to constructively address this matter, at least in parallel to the wider review of the legislation and completed before the end of the financial year. In terms of government response in this industry, I am pleased to report to the House that the annual licensing charges paid by the gambling industry increased in the last financial year. Similarly, employment in the industry grew by 227 posts to 3,252. So, in licensing charges, in POIE, in corporate tax, and in numbers employed, every single one of these have increased from the previous record year that we enjoyed and reported in last year's budget session. The government relationship and engagement with the industry remains very positive, and I have taken steps this year to meet with many of the executives and leaders of the industry to gain their direct feedback on the arrangements and the data, and while there is more of course to do, this is always positive. To end on gaining the future, although legislation and taxation in the sector under review, it goes without saying that this government remains committed to securing a strong and stable future for both the remote gambling and land-based gambling sectors in Gibraltar. The industry is strong and stable in Gibraltar and is supported by an excellent team of people and staff here. My thanks, Mr. Speaker, to Mr. Silver and his team, and to Lorraine Duper and her team at the Gambling Division for the great work they do. At the KPMG e-gaming summit held in April of this year, over 60% of those attending cited the government's support and regulatory framework as one of the major reasons for being here in Gibraltar. I thank them for their superb work throughout the year in delivering that cause. Mr. Speaker, since the Asian Department was set up, it has been providing valuable service and assistance across the private sector. It operates like a problem-solving hub, providing invaluable customer service to the finance centre and gaming sector. Close interaction with other government departments is vital for the process to operate efficiently and effectively, and will become more so as we press to make doing business in Gibraltar even more easy and even more attractive. My thanks to Lagan and Tanya for their support to the private sector, a service which I know they most appreciate. Mr. Speaker, turning to Gibraltar Maritime Administration, I am pleased to announce that in 2016, the Gibraltar Ship Registry managed ably by the Gibraltar Maritime Administration, Richard Mandela, and his team achieved white list status for the very first time, and our registry is now considered one of the top 20 in the world. The results have been published in the annual International Journal of Shipping Flag Safety Performance Table for 2015-2016. The registry rates highly in the ICS Performance Table with positive performance indicators in every aspect. The register also ranks highly in several technical performance levels by the Paris MOU and the Tokyo MOU port, and is recognized as a quality register by the U.S. Coast Guard in the USCG 12-21 system, a target to be used by the U.S. Coast Guard to identify poor quality vessels. In addition to the improvement in quality, Mr. Speaker, the overall Gibraltar fleet has increased slightly this year. Increased competition from our traditional strong markets, such as Germany and Norway, has resulted in a number of ship owners returning to their home flags. The GMA is now diversifying its marketing base by looking at markets in southern Europe, such as Greece and Italy. I'm also pleased to announce that we are reviewing our product at the registry by doing a jurisdictional comparison and identifying areas where we may adapt and improve the registry, as well as its service levels and availability in different and important time zones. Mr. Speaker, in completion of the Lisbon Service in Arena, major Rotarians have taken the opportunity to buy a private. There are now 700 6-foot-meter long beds available here in Gibraltar. The yacht registry is in its final stages of consultation for a completely new registration type for local boat owners. The new small ship registry should be ready for introduction by the end of this month, and this service will allow Gibraltar residents to register and operate small boats and jet skis outside Gibraltar waters. Completing the local red book, complementing the local red book, licensing the blue book, has no restrictions for vessel allocation to Gibraltar. I must highlight that insurance cover and appropriate qualifications will be prerequisites for registration. I mentioned last year, Mr. Speaker, that the GMA is a central authority for maritime trade in Gibraltar and is coordinating within the Gibraltar Port Authority and Ministry for Economic Development to establish a maritime training program for young persons with the financial support of the local banking companies. It is absolutely critical to bring young Gibraltarians into this industry. By the end of this year, we will have a number of maritime courses available both in Gibraltar and abroad. Speaker, I now turn to the commercial aspect of the Port of Gibraltar. In spite of the direct and residual effects of the recent economic crisis and increasing competition in the region, the GPA reported growth in both the total number of ships calling at Gibraltar for bunkers and in the quantity of fuel delivered in 2015. This upward trend was reflected more widely with an increase in the number of cruise liners up by over 13% and CPS calling at Gibraltar up by over 60%. Speaker, the maritime industry is still fighting its way back from the global recession. There is a general downfall in maritime trade, with ship owners constantly trying to cut running costs. This, of course, has an impact on the number of vessels transiting the port. Despite these challenging conditions, I am pleased to report that general activity in Gibraltar remains stable, with bunkering volumes pretty much in line with expectations for the year. Initiatives to increase activity will continue, and I expect to report more favorably in the next session. I'm also pleased to report that in my last budget speech, the initiatives introduced to promote the Port of Gibraltar started to bear fruit, with Gibraltar hosting the International Bunker Industry Association, or IBIA as it's known, annual convention in Gibraltar for the first time ever later this year. The Port Authority is now also represented on the board of IBIA with the recent election of Commodore Bob Fanganetti as a board member. This gives Gibraltar an important and well-respected platform from which to raise our profile globally and allow us to promote the port at the top echelon of the bunkering world. Mr. Speaker, the GPA has continued with its targeted marketing campaign based on direct engagement. I recently visited Singapore to meet some of the biggest ship owners and managers in the world. This was followed with a visit to Hong Kong in conjunction with the Hong Kong office to build on the relationship established when my honourable colleague, Honourable Neil Costa, last visited there in late 2014. I am convinced these efforts are crucial in keeping Gibraltar at the forefront of ship owners and operators' minds, and I must thank those members of our shipping community that joined us in selling Gibraltar PSC in Asia earlier this year. Mr. Speaker, with the opening of government's spectacular small boat arena comes the opportunity to provide an additional 500 metres of berthing space CPS. While early days, it is very encouraging to report that the GPA is receiving much interest from CPS masters who are not just considering Gibraltar as a bunkering port, but rather as a longer stop where crew can enjoy the full range of facilities that we have here. Members will know that we currently have the enormous Le Grand Bleu berth here this week. The government's plan for land-based storage is also underway, with a number of very exciting expressions of interest being considered. These will offer government the opportunity to carry out a wider range of the port as state, including its facilities, which has not happened in many, many years. The GPA is working on its Port Vision 2025 as part of the government's wider initiative to take a long-term view of the port. I must thank Bob Fanganetti and his team for the superb work he and his team have done over the years. None of these very positive results could have been achieved without the excellent relationship between GPA and the Gibraltar Port Operations Service providers. I look forward to continuing to work with them all in the coming year. Before I move on to my closing part, I would like to thank the entire team in my office, under the direction of Julian Balasina, my secretary, Lugo, who are always there for me, providing a professional service and always supporting the work we do, quietly and without fuss. And of course, to mention and thank Susanna, who is recently retired. I wish her a long and happy retirement. They are all appreciated to the civil service, and I am most grateful to each and every one of them. I must also thank Vi and the team at the Rock Reception, who fight on with the living and working in difficult circumstances, which we are looking to reform and improve for the benefit of them all. Mr. Speaker, I referred at the outset of my address to what measures we were looking to take, particularly in the areas of financial services and gaming, in light of the vote of the 23rd of June. In conclusion, Mr. Speaker, I would like to inform this House of the measures that we will adopt in the coming weeks and months in financial services and gaming to best prepare to meet the challenges that lie ahead. As I have already said in this House, it is indeed very much business as usual. But that, of course, does not mean that we will stand still. On the contrary, we will work harder than ever before to preserve the business that we enjoy today and work to seek out the opportunities that the ever-changing landscape makes available to us. What is clear is that whatever changes may come, they will not arrive until 2019 at the earliest. And therefore, we need not panic, but focus and be best prepared in place for whatever change comes our way. We are already reviewing our processes to ensure that the path to new business is as smooth and efficient as is possible. We have made some progress in this regard, but there is more to come. In gaming, we have already, since the vote, communicated with all of our operators in Gibraltar and, of course, with the GBGA. We have informed them to review the Gambling Act, announced earlier this year, following the proposals of the four people, will be extended to analyse and assess the risks of Brexit to our operators and to identify the areas and issues that we as a jurisdiction are able to deal with that will maintain our position as the premier online gaming jurisdiction. This will cover many areas, including arrangements with the UK and other markets with whom we may build direct relationships. We will work with the four people in these areas, as well as, of course, with each of our operators. The gaming community is fully aware of the absolute commitment of this government to tackle the issues they have and to meet the challenges faced together in the months and years ahead. I am convinced that we have the knowledge, expertise and will to make this happen. In financial services, Mr. Speaker, we have been in contact with the Finance Centre Council and with a number of the major players in our insurance community, as well as with most of the investment managers at a face-to-face meeting last Friday morning. It is clear that the UK market is critical and that access to the single market is an important part of some of these businesses. Mr. Speaker, we will certainly be setting up small working groups with professionals in each of the areas of the sector to assist us in determining the risks arising from this uncertainty and to prepare a roadmap for the opportunities that any change to our existing arrangements, if they occur, may present. We will also review our existing product lines and examine new possibilities, as well as review our business plans moving forward. Uncertainty, Mr. Speaker, is bad for business, and we must therefore work to deal with these on a step-by-step basis. As I have already mentioned in this House, we have two new insurance license applications since the 23rd of June before the Financial Services Commission, and I am reliably informed that there are more to come across a number of different areas which is indeed welcome news. These include new lines of business which are exciting and innovative. At this time, our regulator will pull out all the stops to ensure we are efficient and business-friendly in assisting new applicants with the authorization process. We will work to get better at what we do across all areas of these sectors. I would like to thank in advance, Mr. Speaker, the professionals who will form part of this group to assist us in ensuring we are best placed for the future. In political terms, there is no doubt that the first priority must be to confirm unequivocally our relationship with the United Kingdom, enabling our business community to continue to work in and out of the UK, irrespective of the EU relationship. This is critical to our private sector and noted by this government. We must also insist and ensure that whatever arrangements the United Kingdom negotiates for itself must similarly apply to Gibraltar. As the Chief Minister has already said, we are considering and working on all of the options available to us, including short, medium, and long term. This is what responsible government is all about, and in that respect, we shall not be found wanting. The Chief Minister is working with the Majesty's government at the highest level to secure these arrangements, and progress is already being made. Finally, Mr. Speaker, last year saw the continued growth and importance to our communities both in financial services and in our gaming sectors. They both again surpassed their expectations in every respect. We now face new and unknown challenges, and with the sense and determination that we all have, we will again rise to the challenge and the opportunities that will come before us. It is not within our gift to predict what will happen, but it's certainly it is to prepare, and that is exactly what we intend to do. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Neil Costa.
Mr. Speaker, as always, it is with great pleasure that I deliver my budget address in this House. This speech marks my ninth budget contribution as a Member of Parliament and my fifth as Government Minister. It is, Mr. Speaker, my second budget address as Minister with responsibility for business, employment, social services, and the Department of Social Security. During the course of my contribution, I will report on the projects undertaken over the past financial year, and I will set out my ministry's objectives for this financial year. With your indulgence, I will start with my social security responsibilities. Mr. Speaker, as this House will know, prior to the 31st of December 1984, married women whose husbands were paying social insurance contributions and widows who were in employment or self-employment had a choice of paying either the reduced married women rate of contribution or the full rate of social insurance contribution. This option is no longer available, but continues to apply to existing contributors on a personal-to-holder basis. Married women who opted to pay this reduced social insurance contribution were not entitled to claim old age pension in their own right on attaining the age of 60. They could only claim an old age pension and a dependent allowance rate based on the husband's insurance record once the husband reached the age of 65. As the House will also know, the dependent allowance is paid at half the rate payable to the husband. With effect from April of this year, the government introduced legislation to allow married women who pay or are paying the reduced social insurance contribution, or women who have not paid contributions as self-employed persons, to make retrospective payments of the difference between the reduced social insurance and the full social insurance contribution. If the minimum contribution conditions for pension purposes are met, they will be entitled to pension in their own right when they reach the age of 60 or enhance their existing pension rate. Mr. Speaker, I would like to stress that this opportunity will be available until the 31st of March of next year. Mr. Speaker, as this House has been informed, the entire process of awarding disability allowance was informed with effect from July of last year. The Department of Social Security, which administers the allowance, was finding it increasingly difficult to consider the application received in a just and equitable manner based on the brief guidelines available and the absence of professional medical advice. With this in mind, the former Director of Social Security and I took the initiative of overhauling the disability allowance arrangement and introducing a new set of eligibility criteria together with an entirely new assessment process. In this respect, the disability allowance is no longer awarded on the basis of a particular health condition or impairment, but on the impact that such a condition has on the everyday life of the person or his or her carer. An assessment panel made up of health professionals from a range of different health disciplines, including a physician, a psychologist, a physiotherapist, and an occupational therapist, willing to gather diverse expertise and skills, were set up to assess disability allowance applications. As a consequence, entitlement to the allowance is now determined in a new, fairer, and objective assessment of an individual. members may request further assessment from relevant professionals or further medical information to help them in their assessment. The ultimate decision, however, rests with the director, who will make a determination on the award based on the panel's professional recommendation and taking into account all relevant circumstances. If an applicant appeals a decision, the assessment panel composed of different members will convene and reassess the application. The procedure will ensure that the second assessment is considered correct. As a result, those individuals with health condition or impairment have the greatest impact on their day-to-day lives and require the most support are fully caught by our reform. Mr. Speaker, we have worked towards achieving a system that will assess individual needs, ensure consistency of decision making, and make the health process fair and objective. It gives me great satisfaction to say that nearly a year after the inception of the new arrangement, all historical applications have been assessed and all current applications are addressed in a timely manner. In this respect, I wish to state on the record my sincere thanks to the hard-working professionals who volunteer of their time to fulfill this important endeavour. Mr. Speaker, the House is aware that the water old age pensions and survivors' benefits were increased by 1.6% with effect from the 1st of August of last year. In previous years, pensions were increased in line with the annual increase in general index of retail prices. Last year, however, the increase was a mere 0.1%, and for this reason, it was decided to apply the same increase as in the previous year. Furthermore, the minimum income guarantee was also increased by 1.6%. Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable the Chief Minister announced in this budget address, old age pension will increase by the retail price index with effect from the 1st of August. Further, Mr. Speaker, last year was announced that maternity grant would increase from £600 to £700 for births that occurred after the 1st of August of 2015. I know that this increase has been very welcome indeed by all parents enjoying a new addition to the family. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to my responsibilities for the Royal Gibraltar Post Office. On the 1st of January, the RGPO launched the UN Universal Postal Union Customs Declaration Tier system on its webpage to meet the new security requirements for mail items entering the EU. Effective from the 1st of May, the EU makes the provision of advanced electronic information mandatory for postal items entering the EU. Customers sending international mail will no longer have to rely on their own handwriting being correctly interpreted or on a single hard copy of a customs declaration label safely reaching its destination. They can now use the customs declaration kiosk system to provide the customs declaration data in a quick and accurate manner while maintaining full control of the declaration. Our destination, Mr. Speaker, the availability of this declaration data allows customs to prepare risk assessments in advance, enabling nimble inbound customs placement. Currently, the customs declaration kiosk system makes use of the system's unique postal lookup engine to suggest tariff codes for the goods being sent abroad. In the short term, the kiosk will include warnings on prohibitions and restrictions, as well as postal address validation. Mr. Speaker, it's therefore gratifying that a quote from the Post News saying the RGPO is one of the postal operators spearheading this revolution, having already integrated the CPS kiosk on their website. At point of lodging, dedicated customer-facing kiosks are being rolled out to enforce the declaration data capture of all international mail items. Further, Mr. Speaker, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development has signed a memorandum of understanding with the UN Postal Union to facilitate in the area relating to the interface between customs declaration and open customs Africa, where the RGPO is a pilot country. Given the increasingly sensitive aviation safety and security issues facing the global postal network and the recognition of the role Gibraltar Post Office leading in the area on dangerous goods awareness, the RGPO is the cover story in the UN Universal Postal Union Postal Postal publication, yet again giving Gibraltar very positive global exposure. Further, Mr. Speaker, I am pleased to inform the House that due to the success of the Post and Go kiosk, the Gibraltar House kiosk in London has been the World Bank show in New York to launch its new macaque stand. the IBPO kiosk was also on the front cover of the second edition of the Intelligent AR magazine. It's important to note that since the installation of these kiosks at your Bolton House in London, and the premises of the IBPO, almost £40,000 of revenue has been raised. Mr. Speaker, another area where the IBPO has taken centre stage is in improving quality measurement between two countries. The IBPO set up a trial of different radio frequency identification responders to give 100% visibility of mail bags arriving in the UK. The trial was a great success and created a demand for the IBPO to share the best practice. The CEO of the IBPO has presented to three different UN Universal Postal Union committees in other countries like the Netherlands that want to carry out a data experience with Porter. The IBPO has now introduced RFID readers in the cargo shed at the Gibraltar Airport and is now the only country to face passive RFID in all of its mail bags. Mr. Speaker, during this summer, the IBPO should introduce the latest postal chat and phone system called IPS Post to meet its mandatory obligations for data exchange. IPS Post is an application for handling international mail. The IPS Post application will allow postal organisations to store and exchange data related to the mail handling process. IPS Post records information about mail events that happen to an item during each step of the international mail handling process. The IBPO can use the IPS Post system to identify each mail event, that is to say, the specific steps of the mail handling process as defined in international postal regulations that happen to an item from the time it is received from the customer and it is delivered. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, it is a great satisfaction when I can confirm that additional cargo space was secured with Monarch Airlines from Monday, the 6th of July of last year. This has meant that backlog of mail is reduced and is delivered to the recipient sooner. The collaboration is the direct result of a meeting held between the Chief Executive Officer of the IBPO, the Monarch Airlines Cargo Services, and myself. I'm sure that honourable members have had no idea that postal work would be quite so exciting. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to my responsibility for commercial affairs, and before I turn to the tremendous work that the government has achieved in reducing the cost of doing business, let me ask the honourable Mr. Kimpton to take good note of all the matters that I will highlight. Mr. Speaker, his contribution in small businesses is measured by its length, could politely be described as superficial or perhaps defensive. In all, Mr. Speaker, seven paragraphs, the longest of which was a cut and paste from the GFSB survey, and in respect of which was no analysis beyond repeating the concerns of some of its members. On the other hand, if the honourable member's comments on small businesses were analysed frankly for the quality of his analysis, then I must describe it as shocking for its complete lack of knowledge on all of the work that this government has carried out, not just in reducing the administrative burden on businesses, but in revolutionising the way businesses are now licensed and enforcing business costs. I will have much more to say for Mr. Kimpton at the conclusion of my section on small businesses on the honourable member's inexplicable neglect of his duty as a spokesperson on SMEs, evidence not least by the absence of a single question by him at question time. I start with the excellent and newly established Office of Fair Trading. Mr. Speaker, I am delighted to confirm that in October of last year, the Office of Fair Trading, or the OFT, as it's commonly known, opened its doors pursuant to the enactment of the Fair Trading Act. A lot of work continues to be devoted to this project, and I'm happy to say that we've also now both a statutory regulator that caters exclusively to the needs of businesses and consumers. As you are aware, three pre-existing government departments merged to create the OFT, the Department of Consumer Affairs, the Trade Licensing Section, and the Business Support Unit. The OFT is, in addition, responsible for the implementation of the new business licensing system and the establishment of the single point of contact, which I will address shortly. The office is dedicated to maintaining the highest business standards in Gibraltar and is already solving to bolster the confidence of entrepreneurs and consumers in the local market, which economy. Blessing, Mr. Speaker, is sparked by seasoned public servants who are experienced in consumer protection, licensing matters, and providing support to businesses. Furthermore, the operation and management of the new office is carried out by legally qualified chief executive officer who brings to the administration of public services his own experience of working in the private sector. The staff of the OFT has, since before the office was formally established in October, developed a very productive working relationship with other government departments, not least the Income Tax Office, the Department of Employment, Health and Customs, and non-governmental bodies such as Company House. In this respect, Mr. Speaker, written protocols are already in place with the Income Tax Office, the Port Authority, and the Department of Employment to ensure the highest level of practical cooperation. In addition, the OFT, in conjunction with Customs, created a new approved goods list that categorizes all goods that are traded and devolved into a simple, easy to use, and informative list. Further, the OFT staff experience and contact are proving invaluable to the one-stop service for the office offers startup businesses. The OFT continues to work towards even greater cooperation with other bodies for the continued improvement of its services. Mr. Speaker, the OFT and my ministry are involved in a substantially progressed consultation with the Chamber of Commerce and the Gibraltar Federation of Small Businesses to deliver some changes to the Fair Trading Act, which we mutually agree are desirable. In this respect, Mr. Speaker, I will be in a position to publish an amending bill in the last quarter of this year that I am certain will iron out the small creases that we have witnessed in the first 8 months since the commencement of the Act. Mr. Speaker, under the Fair Trading Act, new guidance codes have been set for tourism service providers, real estate service providers, and for businesses handling client monies in Gibraltar. The code set out industry best practice guidelines and non-compliance will be investigated and, where necessary, appropriate action taken by the OFT. These codes of conduct are, among other matters, concerned with the protection of deposit money that are paid by consumers, which in our view requires specific protection. Businesses handling client money or holding financial deposits are required to provide evidence of a separate client account to the OFT. I hope that Mr. Clinton has taken note. Mr. Speaker, one of the most exciting changes in the establishment of the OFT's single point of contact is only to ease the administrative burden of establishing a business in Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, budding business persons are no longer obliged to navigate the labyrinthine administrative morass to start up a business or to keep their business license stamped. It goes without saying, Mr. Speaker, the speed to market is essential, and it is important that administrative procedures do not get in the way of entrepreneurialism and innovation. The Office of Fair Trading assists in focusing new business applications to the right government department by the office itself, speedily, and from one single venue. Entrepreneurs may visit the OFT, conveniently located office at the airport, and receive guidance to complete their registration and licensing processing. The team will then distribute all these forms as necessary to the other departments. In other words, Mr. Speaker, whereas before, and certainly during the time that the DFC were in government with Mr. Clinton now represents in the House, a person will have to attend every establishment, every relevant government office necessary to obtain a business license, such as Environmental Agency, Town Planning Department, Employment Service, and the Department of Social Security, among others. Today, that same person only needs to attend the OFT, is assisted by an experienced official in filling the form, and that same official distributes the form to the department and completes the process with the client. For the business person who previously had to navigate his or her way to Gibraltar and all of those government departments now only deals in one office with one person. The call by the business community for a single client service ignored for over 16 years has finally been answered and allows entrepreneurs to concentrate on what they do best, Mr. Speaker, run a successful business. And further, Mr. Speaker, in the same way as businesses are called to innovate and provide wide-reaching methods of doing business remotely, we as administration are also committed to providing the ability for businesses to deal with government departments easily and efficiently online. Businesses are therefore now able to complete and submit forms required for business licensing online via the e-government website. Furthermore, downloadable versions of all the relevant forms for each of the government departments are also available on the RSE website. Mr. Speaker, as I noted some moments ago, the commencement of the RFT for the absorption of the Department of Consumer Affairs, which has become the RFT Consumer Protection Section. Where the team members themselves have not changed, the nature of the work carried out by the team has shifted from a mediation role to a regulation role. The ultimate aim of the Consumer Protection Division is to prevent harm to consumers. The atmosphere in the RFT must leave its teeth by the creation of consumer protection enforcers to ensure that all businesses comply with this legislation. Since enforcers can visit local traders to review their business practices, inspect weighing and measuring equipment used for trade, and check business licenses to ensure they are in place and up to date. Consumer protection officers are also empowered to monitor and check advertisements for accuracy, to inspect and test goods for safety, ensure that no person is selling goods to consumers without a license, and investigate business practices of the OFT may consider to be significantly harmful to consumers. The members of the team have undergone training from the Chartered Trading Standards Institute earlier this year, with previous training from the Royal Board of Police, ensured best practice methods and procedures when using their enforcement powers. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to business licensing, previously known as trade licensing. In accordance with the Fair Trading Act, the functions of the Trade Licensing Authority have been conferred and subsumed within the remit of the OFT and are undertaken by the BLA, the Business Licensing Authority. The new licensing system created by the Act now requires that all businesses in Gibraltar that are not regulated by another enactment are licensed. This, Mr. Speaker, is the irrational differentiation in law between the requirements of business trading goods and those that provide services. The deduction of the BLA has also marked a significant increase in due diligence checks at the time of applying for a business license to ensure that, among other things, all applicants carrying on business do so from adequate premises and are properly registered and up to date at company house. Mr. Speaker, it is well worth remembering that the Act contains a statutory presumption in favour of carrying on business in Gibraltar subject to obtaining a license. As a result, the new statutory system allows the DLA Secretariat to consider and approve straightforward applications, allowing the DLA Board to consider complex applications. All decisions taken by the Secretariat are communicated to the DLA and are based on precedents previously established by the Board. This is the effect of dramatically improving the speed in which applications are processed. Where all documents are received and the applications do not need to be referred to the Board, applications are processed within 3 working days, Mr. Speaker. Quite well, I said. Crucially, the BLA has the ability to deploy the RFT-CP forces to investigate businesses that it suspects are not in possession of a valid business license. Another significant change that improves the efficiency of the business licensing process is that the BLA is now required by statute to meet fortnightly rather than monthly. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to my responsibility for small and medium-sized businesses. As an enterprise says, small businesses are the lifeline for our economy, and the government must enable the right conditions for businesses to flourish. It is significant to note that collectively, small and medium-sized businesses are Gibraltar's biggest employer. It therefore gives me great satisfaction, Mr. Speaker, to set out the many budgetary measures that the government introduced to buttress the right legal, regulatory, economic, and fiscal conditions for success. Mr. Speaker, let me highlight some of the main measures. The government has, in the first place, maintained energy prices at the same rate since 2011, with a promise not to increase the same for an additional 4 years. Mr. Speaker, I should remind the House that the Chief Administration admitted that having proceeded with a Lathbury Barrett power plant, utility costs would have increased by 5% on annual. This, therefore, already represents a saving for small businesses of 20% over 4 years. But still, in addition to this 20% saving, we need to add the 5.6% discount over the last 4 financial years, representing inflation over that period. So in total, so far, a saving of 25.65%. Even further still, Mr. Speaker, this does not take into account the important amount by which the government subsidizes the cost of electricity. It is important, therefore, for the business community to reflect on the effect on their business costs if the government were to remove such a subsidy. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, we have not increased social insurance contributions in 4, 9, 5 financial years, Mr. Speaker. Rather, government has abolished employee contributions in respect of an employee's secondary employment, subject to the full contribution having been paid once in the water. As the Honourable the Chief Minister has noted, we will need to consider developments in the UK arising from a Brexit vote, and we may have to review the position later on in the year. Thirdly, we have undertaken import duty reductions on the widest range of goods. This year has been noticed, Mr. Speaker, and there have been even further import duty reductions on 12 items. Our anecdotal evidence, however, firmly suggests that regrettably, some traders are not passing such savings to consumers. Fourthly, we have provided discounts for early repayment of rates of 65% for businesses in the first year of trading for new set-up companies. For those new companies that have already received a 50% general rate discount in the first year of trading since the scheme was introduced, they were given a 25% discount in the second year of trading. Fifth, Mr. Speaker, we have increased the discount for early payment of rates from 10% to 15% for offices, workshops, construction, and manufacturing industries, transport, and distribution industries. This discount will, of course, continue once again in this financial year. We have allowed companies, partnerships, and self-employed individuals to claim 100% of its eligible capital allowance in the first year of trade in order to further incentivize new businesses to set up in what the economists have called our tiger-like economy and generate further economic activity. Further still, following proposals from Ofcom in order to incentivize training in the workplace, allows training costs as an expense against profit of a business or company at the rate of 150%. Mr. Speaker, that means that a company can invest £1,000 in training its employees with a view to them obtaining an accredited qualification, will now be able to claim £1,500 as a deduction against profit for the accounting period in the tax computation. Even further still, we have raised the audit threshold, that is to say, the level of turnover beyond which audited accounts are required, from £1 million to £1.25 million. A measure that does not go down very well with my girlfriend as a qualified accountant. And the ninth point, Mr. Speaker, in order to assist small-scale startups, introduced a cap 200% credit in respect of the cost of only architect's fees incurred in respect of successful planning applications under the Town Planning Act, and any fees charged by government in respect of any such planning application made by such a company in respect of its property in the first 24 months of operation. Further still, to further encourage and assist small businesses and profit companies, we introduced a social insurance credit of £100 per employee in respect of employers' contributions to companies who have 10 or less employees. And as an 11th budget busting measure for small businesses, Mr. Speaker, an additional startup incentive scheme was announced this year by the Honourable the Chief Minister. Any company that sets up in Gibraltar over the next 12 months and meets various conditions, among others, then it must be a new business, must employ 5 employees in the first year, and if the business is not a transfer of a business previously existing, or one that is used as a transfer pricing mechanism to allocate profits from a business previously existing, is eligible for the scheme. And the excellent incentive, Mr. Speaker, is that over the first 3 financial years of trading, the business, which can be a company or a limited partnership, will be eligible for a tax credit equal to the tax due up to a maximum of £50,000 over each of the first 3 years. The tax credit does not carry forward from 1 year to the next and is not eligible for repayment. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, the Incentive Act as a mechanism to set up a liability to tax up to the maximum of tax equivalent to £50,000 per annum, effectively totaling £500,000 of profit every year. Mr. Speaker, in the light of all of the measures I have just mentioned, the Business Support Unit has carried out an internal exercise to determine how all these measures have affected businesses in Gibraltar. I am very grateful to the 2 businesses in Main Street and the 1 just outside Main Street, which helped us in this task. In essence, Mr. Speaker, we factored into our financial comparison analysis the cost in relation to social insurance, the minimum wage, electricity and water, source water and waste, license fees, and import duty, since this administration was elected and compared and contrasted the cost of doing business over the last 5 years over the average cost of doing business when the honourable members of the state were in government. Mr. Speaker, the forensic analysis determined that in 5 years, the Main Street businesses have made a saving of just over £17,000 and £18,000 respectively, and the business just outside Main Street made a saving of nearly £9,000. It is therefore estimated that with this administration, the businesses that participated in our exercises have saved, on average, approximately a staggering £3,500 every year. And the British left outside Main Street made a saving of just over £1,700. Mr. Speaker, by any objective measure and analysis, keeping the cost of business is well and truly down, and it is business friendly administration. Mr. Speaker, yet another measure which continues to be of great benefit to businesses is the Gibraltar Business Nursing Scheme, or GBNS, that was introduced last year. It may be useful, Mr. Speaker, to quickly explain the logistics of the process for Mr. Clinton and for those who may be interested in applying. The application process for these loans sees applicants complete a simple form. The applications are scored by a committee comprised of a Chamber representative, a GSSC representative, and a government official. The scores take into consideration the status of the loan and evaluate the application against the criteria, ranging from evidence of demand, innovation, sustainability, value for money, the safeguarding and creation of jobs, environmental and health impact, e-commerce, urban renewal, and touristic value. Applications are given a preliminary score. Applicants who obtain a satisfactory score meet with the committee. The meeting allows the applicant to meet with individuals operating in the business field and avail themselves of a share prior to launching or expanding their business. After the meeting, the scores are finalised and a majority recommendation is made for my final approval. As always, Mr. Speaker, I am happy to accept 100% of the committee's recommendations. As you all know, Mr. Speaker, seed capital is an essential part of starting a business or accelerating an existing business. The GBNS has eased the financial burden on aspiring entrepreneurs who may have had an exciting business idea but lack the funds to proceed. The GBNS has also assisted existing businesses that required an injection of capital in order to expand or diversify their business. The GBNS has proved to be a popular mechanism with 19 applications received in the last financial year and 7 successful applications approved. The GBNS has received a second batch of 17 applications, which the committee is currently processing. The availability, Mr. Speaker, of sound and repayable finance is not just vital to grow our economy, but is equally important in creating employment opportunities, generating government revenue, fostering technological innovation, and expanding the range of goods and services enjoyed by consumers. Mr. Speaker, what economists call a virtuous economic cycle. Mr. Speaker, as I have just highlighted, over the past 4 years, and indeed in this financial year, the government has already introduced a series of budgetary measures to assist and encourage startups. And this financial year, we will start work with the GSSC and the Water Chamber of Commerce to consider the elements of an incubator scheme for startups, where startups can be nurtured for the first year of their existence. This will be particularly useful for startups in the software and technology industry, which will seek to further nurture, and I'm personally thrilled to pursue this particular project. But speaker, I must also mention the business support unit last year organised 16 seminars, which became very popular and covered a whole range of topics aimed at providing the local business community with guidance and support. The BSC is currently in the process of preparing a new programme for this year, which I very much look forward to launch. Mr. Speaker, therefore, there is no question that in the past 4.5 years we have worked extremely closely with representatives of the local business community, where I'm happy to consider them, and we have heard and moved on their representations and how where possible with individual concerns and cases. Government will, of course, continue to listen to the business community and move swiftly to tackle any issues that may arise. We will continue to engage in meaningful dialogue with the GSSC, the Water Chamber of Commerce, and individual cases. Further, Mr. Speaker, in the light of the UK referendum results, and in keeping with the honourable achievements we've pledged to set up various working groups, I will invite the Chamber, the GSSC, and other stakeholders to analyse the possible consequences of divorce leaving, the UK divorce leaving the review, of which I will say a little more later, and devise different models depending on the various outcomes. And it is in the light of this robust legal, regulatory, fiscal, and economic architecture that this government has rolled out in its first mandate, and which I've just set out in detail, then Mr. Clinton's bid looks further to form businesses must be judged. Mr. Speaker, such is the angle Mr. Clinton's intimate knowledge of the concerns of businesses that will refer to the Diversity Federation of Small Businesses, throughout his 30,000 small businesses, as the GSSB. In other words, the Gibraltar Small Federation of Businesses. Not quite the same thing, Mr. Speaker. Not least given that the GSSC represents at least half of the business community that it intends to care about. Mr. Speaker, I almost fell off my chair when he called the increase in business licenses a sales tax. Mr. Speaker, if you say this in grain, you're a public political process that he is unaware that the SGO was the product of the fullest consultation with the Chamber and the GSSC over 3 entire years. Don't trust me looking, Mr. Speaker, about engaging with a representative of small businesses that he was not aware that both the GSSC and the Chamber, in fact, agreed with the new licensing fee? Mr. Speaker, does he still think that increases of fees which have not been increased since 1988 and agreed in a public consultation is arrived by self? Mr. Speaker, I think it is fair to say that it has ranked in the course of this party debate as one of the most nonsensical statements offered. It is only fair, fully, to increase fees by inflation in the light of the enforcement powers contained in the SGO. Further, Mr. Speaker, if you had bothered to ask a question time, I would have told him that moving forward, all increases are in line with retail price increases. Mr. Speaker, I could say more. Well, in fact, I will. The Honourable Gentleman in his contribution, the Honourable Gentleman in his contribution does not even refer to any one of the excellent business models that the Honourable Gentleman has introduced. Not one. Not even the very exciting set of things. And Mr. Speaker, in complete illogical defiance of the law of sales, which helps me suggest to the Honourable Gentleman to stop digging when already in a hole, he says that this government is not transparent. Mr. Speaker, I will urge the Honourable Member to take one, anyone, of the budget supplied by the former Chief Minister. If it is, Mr. Speaker, I will invite him to choose any one single question and answer session reflecting his answer. Any reply and any session we do, and on considering any given one, he would come to the same conclusion as I, that there does not exist any currently accepted mathematical measurement that can fully measure the contrast between our huge level of transparency and theirs when in office. In the absence of such a qualitative measurement, Mr. Speaker, I have settled on the basic measure of bucket load. And I will tell them, without hesitation or reserve, that this government is a bucket load more transparent, a bucket load more open, a bucket load more accessible, a bucket load more effective, a bucket load more efficient, and a bucket load more considerate and caring than the pernicious and pensionist style of politics that they describe when in office. Every time I come to this house prepared with what I think is called a statement like a best contribution, but they always have to say something that makes my blood boil, and I feel that I must reply. And I have to say, Mr. Speaker, it was that pernicious style of politics that motivated me to enter politics in the first place, to excise from the public political life and discourse for good and for better that style of politics. And may I say, Mr. Speaker, mission accomplished. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to my responsibility for employment, where I'm sure all honourable members will agree they have not stood still either. Over the past year, the Department of Employment has been improving the quality of the services that it offers to its customers. The digitization of forms that support the government's objective to ease the administrative burden of businesses, which offers round-the-clock, online functionality with virtual access to the department, has been live since October of last year. The portal allows members of the public with an electronic ID card to complete and submit all necessary forms online. In addition, I very pleased to report that Erasmus for Schools, a purpose-built program specifically designed to cater for divorces, particular labour market needs, is fully functional. Yes, sir. The program not only performs the basic tasks that are currently carried out by the present system, such as the registration of those in employment, the listing of the unemployed, and other tasks. This uniquely tailored software also carries out operations that we were unable to perform with the previous programs, such as matching unemployed persons to specific vacancies with certain qualifications or experience are required. The new software accomplishes this by cross-referencing and analyzing key information such as qualifications, experience, skills, and other requirements. With the introduction of this program, Mr. Speaker, along with the option to submit forms online, staff of the employment service will be able to operate more efficiently, allowing them to further assist the unemployed or those in employment who are seeking different opportunities. In order to enhance the opportunity of those registered as unemployed, the department will request all unemployed persons to submit their qualifications. Mr. Speaker, part and parcel of our strategy to keep unemployment down is the effective deployment of the labouring sector. The sectors that work hard in the field to ensure that all employers comply with employment legislation and that, among other things, they concede a registered with employment service in good time to allow us to choose suitable persons for companies to interview them. From April of last year to March of this year, the section carried out 848 inspections, 38 fixed penalty notices, and 37 breaches of the Act have been dealt with by regularising employee positions. In respect of the health and safety inspector, I am pleased to report the principal health and safety inspector position, which had been vacant since August of 2006, has now been filled and the newly selected candidate is in post. A further two posts will now be advertised, bringing the complement of the inspector to size. A new programme of inspections is being considered, and meetings with contractors are being taking place to ensure good working practices. Mr. Speaker, the House should also be aware that the government is currently conducting a substantive review of the legal, regulatory, and practical architecture relating to health and safety at the workplace. In this respect, it gives me great pleasure to say that the government recently introduced a new health and safety policy specifically designed for Gibraltar as part of 2017, Mr. Speaker, the government is breaking new ground by creating health and safety codes, especially for Gibraltar, and the first policy establishes first industry practice guidelines that will be applicable initially to the public sector. Further, a new health and safety advisory council has been established, the composition of which has been decided as the newly introduced health and safety policy. The first meeting took place in May, and the next meeting, Mr. Speaker, is scheduled for September. Service Bill, the Department of Employment is proud to offer the services of an employment counsellor who is working side by side with the employment officers. The employment counsellor is a qualified therapeutic counsellor whose function is twofold. The first objective is to guide all persons to register as unemployed with regard to qualifications or training required to increase their employment prospects. And secondly, for the counsellor to visit the secondary school and the George College and make students aware of the fields or professions in which they are more likely to find employment in our labour market. The new structured program is available to young persons between the ages of 14 to 19 in the form of workshops and one-to-one tuition and interviewing techniques, CV production and any other skills required by the unemployed that will assist them in gaining meaningful employment. The program complements the services already offered by the Department of Education, which has a teacher in each of the secondary schools to offer career advice. The Employment Development Services, Speaker, is yet another strand of the government's multi-track employment strategies, which aim to find employment opportunities for those seeking employment. Mr. Speaker, in respect of injustice of union reform, given that we will debate the merits of the Employment Amendment Bill, under which the Employment of Union Reform will be offered later on the bank, I will only say here that the consultation in respect of the crucial reform is now complete, that the government is ready to proceed, and that I very much look forward to its implementation. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to the rate of employment in Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, before I am unfairly accused, as I was once, by the Honourable Mr. Phillips, that the government is somehow playing with figures when fighting our magnificent unemployment numbers, let me first take the House through the employment survey. In the first place, the Statistics Office confirms, black and white, Mr. Speaker, the fact of growth in employee jobs in our economy. The total number of employee jobs in Gibraltar increased by 1,722 to 26,144. This, Mr. Speaker, is the highest number ever recorded and is a testament to the success of our economy. Mr. Speaker, we can also boast the highest number ever of Gibraltarians in employment at 11,010. Further, Mr. Speaker, it is the private sector, not the public sector, that saw a growth by 1,629 to 20,070 in October of last year. In this respect, the top three industries were, as you would expect, Mr. Speaker, construction, real estate and business activities and hotels and restaurant industries. The public sector saw an increase of 132. As my colleague, the Honourable Minister Wassana, has explained in his contribution, the available Gibraltarian workforce at any one time is estimated by combining the numbers registered as seeking employment and those in employment. The exercise serves to indicate the reliability of the results of the employment survey based by comparing data from two sources. The registered unemployed in October of 2014 was 206, and the comparable figure for 2015 was 268, a drop of 38. The number of Gibraltarians in part-time employment in October 15 is 38 more than the number in October of the previous year, as shown in the survey report. The total number of Gibraltarians in employment, however, only increased by 19, because in the same period there was a reduction in the number of Gibraltarians in full-time employment in the MOD in excess of 19. There has been an increase in part-time private sector jobs and a decline in MOD full-time jobs in the year between the two surveys. That explains the net effect. The correlation of these results is, as the Honourable Minister Wassana has said, a sound indicator of the absolute accuracy of the picture painted by the survey report and the unemployment figures. Mr. Speaker, it is in the light of these statistics and the explanatory notes provided on this same Friday by the Honourable Minister Fuller, which I have no shame in posting just now for the purposes of explaining the survey, that I try to consider the unemployment figures. As the House knows, the employment survey is in effect a snapshot of the bulk of labour market in October compared to the previous October. And it is for the purposes of making the employment survey intelligible that I revealed that the unemployment figure for the month of October 14 was 306 and we were 268 for October 15. In other words, Mr. Speaker, there is clearly a downward trend in the rate of unemployment. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, as the House is aware, 2015 saw the lowest ever level of recorded unemployment over the entire calendar year. In this respect, the quarterly averages were 282, 204, 207, and 255. And it has to be said, Mr. Speaker, that these employment statistics and the rate of employment do put to shame the record of the opposition when in government, which in almost 16 years saw the employment of fewer full-time people paying than we saw in 1 year. Think about that, Mr. Speaker. Think about that. There were, in 16 years when they were in government, fewer people paying employed than we managed to ensure in just 1 year in office. The difference in liberals in 4 years who coming into office have succeeded in assisting our economy to ensure 730 full-time jobs for Gibraltarians, while the GSP, in a period of almost 16 years, had ensured 357 full-time Gibraltarian jobs. Under the GSP, therefore, there was an average of 21 Gibraltarians employed a month, whereas our enviable record is an average of 182 Gibraltarians every year for the first 4 years in office. Mr. Speaker, in what is certainly further excellent news, 168 of the total of 276 trainees who are employed by the five government training companies are now employed in the private sector. Mr. Speaker, this House is also aware of the focus and concerted effort between my ministry and the Department of Employment in identifying vacancies the government approved contractors. The conditions of the pre-contractor scheme administered by the Honourable Minister Rosano stipulate that companies involved must ensure all employees are registered with the Department of Employment prior to commencing work and throughout the term of the contract. Furthermore, contractors are required to employ workers specifically identified to them by the Employment Service from the list of registered unemployed persons. My ministry, with employment officers, have attended to organise interviews for individuals currently unemployed with the respective service providers. Furthermore, the Employment Career Service continues to organise training programmes and interviews and other skills to prepare the candidates for the forthcoming interviews. It's obviously intended that the interview skills seminars increase an applicant's chance of succeeding at the interview stage. This figure I cannot stress enough. The tremendous level of work that has been undertaken to organise the interviews with these companies, and I publicly thank each and every member of the staff at my ministry and the employment officers for their meaningful and tireless efforts. I also congratulate the Career Development Service for helping to improve the interview and presentation skills of the candidates. Mr. Speaker, ultimately, the successful selection of these applicants means that there will be a good number of previously unemployed persons engaged in employment. And even though, of course, it is very rewarding for us to assist the unemployed where we can, of far greater importance is the stability, meaning, and purpose that comes, in fact, from being in employment. And therefore, it is very disappointing when unemployed persons do not attend interviews we arrange for them, and sometimes turn down a job, or sometimes more than one job offer, Mr. Speaker. Such a handful of persons may not realise that they make it just that little bit harder for other persons sent by my ministry and the Employment Service for an interview. As a result, Mr. Speaker, the Director of Employment has met with these individuals and advised them in no uncertain terms that failure to attend interviews or the refusal of job offers may prevent them from registering as unemployed for a period of time. In this respect, it is important to stress that my ministry and employment services only arrange an interview with an employer if the unemployed person has already expressed an interest after being fully informed of the job description and the company. But in any case, Mr. Speaker, to continue on a positive note, it is very gratifying for me personally and as a government minister to report to the House that since we implemented a focused strategy of working closer with the government of food contractors in June, we have identified 160 vacancies, we have arranged 202 interviews, and we have successfully ensured the employment of 88 previously unemployed persons over a 4-week period, Mr. Speaker. As a result, I think that there will be no doubt that we will be able to fill the vacancies that we've identified with the food contractors for those who register as unemployed. Mr. Speaker, with your indulgence, I will now read from a quote in a local magazine of a young Gibraltarian who said, and I quote, "I left Bayside with my GCSEs, but I'm not very academic. I know levels in university weren't really for me. So I went down to employment, or up to employment, and a really great careers advisor helped me out. We worked for my CV, and soon enough I had a job in a gaming company. The company saved me, and after my 1 month trial, they offered me a permanent full-time job. I'm happy here, and I'm told that if I do well, there will be opportunity for me to move up to the company in the future. My parents are really proud of me, and it goes to show that there are opportunities for everyone if you are willing to work for it. And I'm not the only one. I have many friends who also got jobs after getting help and advice from the employment service, and I know that unemployment is down to an all-time low, which can only be a very good thing." End quote. Further, Mr. Speaker, we will now quote just one more person who recently said that Gibraltar leads a blessed life. We lead a blessed life living in Gibraltar. We have got very low levels of unemployment. We invest hugely in our caring, in our social services, in our education system, which funds our young people all the way to postgraduate level. Mr. Speaker, I have to say that I entirely agree with that statement, and I wish to place on the record formally my thanks to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, for being gracious in verifying the success of the government's various employment strategies. It takes courage, Mr. Speaker, for the Leader of the Opposition to admit that the government's policies are bearing fruit and working effectively. Mr. Speaker, I therefore have no doubt that everybody, including clearly the Honourable Gentleman opposite, agree that the increased number of Gibraltarians in the labour market and the reduced levels of unemployment is sensational news. Success beats success, and I strongly believe that our economy will continue to develop even in the face of the recent current political changes that may be caused as a result of Brexit, to which I now turn briefly. Mr. Speaker, the times they are changing. Or are they? On the 24th of June, we are awake to the unthinkable reality that a plurality of UK citizens have voted to leave the European Union, even though we here in Gibraltar voted by an overwhelming 96% to remain. Whereas the referendum is merely advisory, the UK has still to stop the process of extracting itself from the EU under Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, whilst all EU laws and fundamental freedoms continue to apply until the conclusion of the Article 50 process, and whereas there is doubt as to when or even whether the next UK Prime Minister will commence the process under Article 50, the government and this Parliament, I think, must proceed on the basis that Westminster will give effect to the will of the people as expressed in the referendum. Mr. Speaker, the political storm that has been unleashed in Westminster following the vote to leave is certainly unprecedented since my time following British politics. We do not know who will succeed the Prime Minister on the 9th of September, but we do know that he has said, that there may be a case for an early general election. The current frontrunner, Mr. May, however, seems to have dismissed an early election and assert that Brexit means Brexit. Where that it be so simple, though, Mr. Speaker? A report by the top constitutional lawyers have set out that the Prime Minister will need parliamentary approval to trigger Article 50. There are various prospect reports that suggest, and I recall specifically one reporting on that Tory grandee, Michael Hutchinson, who said that because there is a majority of approximately 150 MPs who are against the UK leaving the EU, there could be resistance to vote in favour of the UK government starting the Article 50 process. On Monday, a UK newspaper carried the news that a prominent Muslim had taken two action litigations against the UK government to seek assurances that Article 50 would not be commenced without an act of Parliament. The article added that the Muslim has instructions to pursue the matter to the court if they are not satisfied that the UK government will follow the court process to, and I quote, protect the constitution and sovereignty of Parliament in these unprecedented circumstances. Of course, it took government lawyers just a couple of days to come out to say that, in their view, the Prime Minister could, in fact, start the Article 50 process without reference to Parliament. Further, in the event of a snap election recall, we have to wait and see which party, if any, has a majority and how such a majority intends to deal with their friendly results. At this point, the Liberal Democrats have committed to keeping Britain in Europe, and the Labour Party are undergoing what can be kindly characterised as an internal leadership panel. What is clear is that the resignation en masse of the Labour Front bench and the vote of no confidence in Mr Corbyn, resulting in 172 votes against and 40 in favour, has risen due to what is generally perceived to be Mr Corbyn's lacklustre advocacy for Britain to stay within the EU during the campaign. Further, Mr Speaker, the Prime Minister has announced that there is no chance of a second referendum, notwithstanding the petition that has garnered over 4 million signatures and will set up a new cross-department advisory unit. But notwithstanding that statement, Mr Speaker, from the UK Prime Minister, one can't help but remember the time that the Irish voted on the Lisbon Treaty in a referendum and rejected the Lisbon Treaty, and then, of course, held a second referendum and voted in favour, thereby achieving what the establishment thought was the right result. So far, is it not, Mr Speaker? And Mr Speaker, one thing is left wondering why the Prime Minister, in a representative democracy, where Parliament is supreme decision-making forum, called for a referendum on the UK's membership of the EU in the first place, not least given that he subsequently campaigned with so much ardour and enthusiasm for Britain to stay. I was feeling it would have been enough for Mr Cameron to keep his earlier promise to hold a referendum on any new treaty, rather than to hold a referendum on membership. I cannot but express profound regret for the various wildly unsubstantiated claims made by the Leave campaign, for which they have, subsequent to the vote, tried to walk back. It is nothing short of cynical, Mr. Speaker. The statements were made that were clearly not accurate, and which we can assume will have led millions to vote to leave the EU. It is even more incredible still, secondly, that the architects of the Leave campaign have clearly been caught out without a plan for Britain outside of the EU. And to boot, the leader of the Leave campaign has decided not to stand for the leadership of the Conservative Party after having led the Leave campaign and for which he must have been part of the political responsibility. And the less said about Mr Farage and his resignation, I think, the better. The House will no doubt condemn such reckless disregard for truth in political debate and for the very real consequences that could arise for our present stability, Mr. Speaker. While Westminster has been consumed by the fallout of the referendum vote, we in Gibraltar have pulled together and are more determined than ever before to get this process exactly right. Our community will have seen the government and the opposition close rank. I will have witnessed the Honourable the Chief Minister and the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister waste no time whatever in meeting with the UK government to fully and robustly put forward Gibraltar's position. Gibraltar also knows that the government is exploring every possible avenue to discuss all options. Further, we on this side of the South are meeting with all of our respective stakeholders to discuss the present situation and to analyse in detail the various models available depending on the different possible permutations that may emerge. We stand, Mr. Speaker, of course, ready in solidarity with our entire community, to work harder than ever before and leave no stone unturned in searching for opportunities in what is currently a sea of uncertainty. And Mr. Speaker, the fruits of the work of the Chief Minister and Deputy Chief Minister are already evident, as the Prime Minister himself has said that the UK government will involve Gibraltar in negotiating a new deal with the EU to protect and safeguard Gibraltar's interests. This, of course, is excellent news and will be welcomed by the entire community and by the financial and business sectors. Mr. Speaker, if this to the extent that nothing has happened to sever the relationship with the EU after the referendum, this is unusual. Given the no further steps towards separation from the EU will take place, as in September and earlier, this is government, parliament, and all sectors of our community, the time and the space to carefully consider all our options, firmly establish the voice of the citizens with the UK government, and stress the importance of full access to the single market, and for us, of course, to continue the vital work of looking at all models. It is time, Mr. Speaker, for clear heads, sober analysis, and a lot of hard work. It is time, Mr. Speaker, for us in this House to lead. Our compatriots can rest assured that the government will continue, as until now, to be fully accessible and to be fully engaged in the important work of addressing their concerns and working to fulfil their aspirations. Mr. Speaker, as I conclude, I thank all of my staff and my ministry, the Office of Fair Trading, the Department of Employment, the Department of Social Security, and the Royal Trade, the Post Office, for the at almost all times unforgiving pace they have come to expect and love from me, and for the increasing support in delivering our exciting programme for government. It is true to say, Mr. Speaker, that it would simply not be possible for me to have been able to stand in the South to make as many announcements or to report on the completion of as many projects without them, and I owe all of them, therefore, a very good thank you. And of course, Mr. Speaker, I take the opportunity to thank yourself and the kind, patient, and excellent assistance of your staff, namely the clerk, Francis, Kevin, and Danny. Thank you.
After that, there's still the force of business and politics. Generally, can I invite the House to recess for a few moments for tea?
I then will call upon Mr. Andrew Phillips to exercise his right to make his contribution to this debate. The Honourable Andrew Phillips.
Mr. Speaker, being elected to Parliament on the 27th of November 2015 was a great honour and privilege. I wish to thank all of those who entrusted me with their vote, all 4,784 of them, and it's given me the opportunity to serve this community as a frontline opposition member in this House. My election to this House has given me the opportunity to speak to those people who feel distant from the political process, but who also have ideas on how we can do things better. I am grateful to the many people who attempted to make the steep learning curve easier and who have guided me through what has seemed at times as a minefield. I very much look forward to the challenges ahead and serving my community together with my parliamentary colleagues in any way I can. I promise where I can, I will help. If I can't, I will stay, but I will always listen. I became an MP because I am passionate about our young people and about the creation of better opportunities for the young and those who, for whatever reason, have been unable to access opportunity. I believe that our young people are Gibraltar's future ambassadors, and each and every young person, irrespective of ability, represents a golden opportunity for our community. That is why, in our view, the building of skills through real training is so very important for the future success of our economy. It is no secret, Mr. Speaker, that we fundamentally oppose the future job strategy. It fails to deliver what it says on the tin. It is reactive, inflexible, and inspires us with little confidence on this side of the House that the government is committed to the delivery of skills for the modern workforce. I know that those members opposite disagree with this subject, on me on the subject of skills and training, as is their right, and I respect them for maintaining their view. But despite our attempts at broadcasting our message on skills and training, they don't seem to appreciate the distinctions we are making. The was well and good, very well and good, building a nation. But we need to focus on sowing the seeds of growth, even though those green shoots may not be visible for some time. Politics must be about doing what is right and what is in the long-term interest of this community. This is why the focus of my budget address will be on opportunity, creating better opportunities for our young people, the vulnerable, and the unemployed. The Honourable Father of the House said yesterday that diversification of our economy is important so that we don't rely on one set of skills. I could not agree more with that assessment. It mirrors my own system. However, as I will demonstrate, this is not what is being achieved by the future job strategy. Politics has allowed me the opportunity to speak to many young people who already can see the opportunities but cannot unlock them without support. We believe that by unlocking and harnessing the opportunities that young people present, we can make Gibraltar an even better proposition, just as Tel Aviv and Budapest have done, for example. But we cannot do this unless we have an honest and constructive debate about skills and learning. I respect the view of Mr. Bofano, but I cannot agree with his approach. During the election in 2007, he said that he'd waited 15 years to implement what he described by some commentators as a Soviet-style job strategy. Mr. Speaker, building a successful economy depends on the creation of better opportunities for our young people. It cannot happen overnight, and it certainly cannot happen by operating a plugging the skills gap policy that the government is determined in pursuing. Mr. Speaker, I do not say this in any way to score political points or to be controversial. My remark is solely designed to demonstrate through argument and debate that we need to proactively shape our own future by using the human capital available to us rather than reactively plugging the skills gap. We need to focus on supporting and encouraging startups in IT, software development, coding, and maybe perhaps industries allied to and supportive of our gaming industry, to name a few. Mr. Speaker, I remain absolutely convinced that we need to do a lot more to truly harness the human capital we have in our community. After all, our principal asset is our people, and we cannot be wrong when we cannot be wrong to invest in your own people. Our recent outreach campaign to the unemployed demonstrates that we need to do much more to secure the long-term future of the unemployed and our young people. I believe that we are starving our young people of the vital oxygen they need by not creating employment opportunities and trying to force young people into random and often unsuitable work. How are we planning for the future? What skills, trades and degrees will be needed for the future? And why are we not targeting our efforts in this way? These are just a few of the questions that are being put to me on a regular basis. Not everyone, thankfully, is an accountant, banker, lawyer, or financial advisor, and I think Mr. Clinton will absolutely agree with that analysis. Not everyone is destined for academia, but everyone, irrespective of ability, deserves the dignity of work and the opportunity to provide for themselves. We need to create an environment for people to flourish. The modern apprenticeships in Germany and the United Kingdom are an excellent workable example, and we need to learn from that experience. We need to bring back apprenticeships in the modern context to meet the needs of new technology business. Many people we speak to about the old apprenticeships speak about them with pride, but they also feel that we're losing these old traditional skills. We can learn from the experience of those who underwent the old apprenticeships, and we all know what they are, and apply the same rationale to building a modern, successful apprenticeship program. Mr. Speaker, I support the initiative put forward by the Honourable Mr. Foster to get back people into work, but we must do more than simply skills minutes, and I appreciate he is doing more, but I think we need to do it differently. We must look to where Gibraltar will be within the next 20 years and what industries will grow our economy and improve the lives of our people. We have a responsibility for future generations of Gibraltarians to develop and create better opportunities. Mr. Speaker, we must continue to encourage a strong effort, work ethic, both in the private and the public sector. We must weed out the culture of entitlement and expectation that has become so endemic in our society. Many in our community were not surprised to hear the Minister for Employment so publicly chastise those persons who failed to engage with the government's employment initiative.
No one, in my view, who is out of work and is off of work should be permitted to pick and choose if they are not in a position to do so. We need to engender a culture of responsibility, civic pride and respect, and rid the community of the culture of entitlement and expectation. Each and everyone has an obligation to this community to leave it in a better position than they found it and make a contribution to its success. I have long advocated in and outside of this place for the need for robust modern apprenticeship programs, which meets the needs of future generations, despite the real reluctance of the father of the house to accept any criticism and engage with them constructively. I appreciate that one of the Minister of the Planet has a wealth of experience in this area, but we need to start looking at skills differently. The world has changed and continues to change, Mr. Speaker, and we need to be flexible and dynamic to move with it. The father of the house challenged me in this house by saying that no employers who had approached me before and after the election came forward. The father of the house seeks skills and training with a new tax-free rose-tinted spectacle. The reality, of course, Mr. Speaker, is very different. Those companies who have approached me have already approached the government with impressive plans for creating opportunities for our young people. But there was no interest, I am told, by these companies. These companies have no reason, Mr. Speaker, to complain. They care about providing opportunities for our young people and getting young libertarians and libertarians into the IT world. Mr. Speaker, I am comforted by the fact that the Honourable Mr. Foster is thinking along the same lines as I am, and I extend to him the particular hand of cooperation in a genuine attempt to work together so that we can build a modern apprenticeship programme that allows those young people who cannot access opportunities the chance to thrive as others have thrived. Mr. Speaker, we must all in this House acknowledge that technology is the future. This has been recognised by the Honourable Mr. Lefebvre in his budget address in 2015, where he outlined what has been done to encourage coding at primary education level. He repeated that in his 2016 speech, and I congratulate him in respect to work he has done in relation to primary level. I'll talk a bit more about that in relation to education slightly later. On that basis, it must be right that we strive for consistency in our approach to the learning of skills at every level and roll out programs to the young. I am grateful to those employers who continue to reach out to us and assist us in developing our strategy in this particular area. We on this side of the House believe that there is a strong relationship with education and more can be done to develop an information technology or a school of computing within the jurisdiction of the University of Gibraltar. I know that Mr. McCready has referred that in press remarks and we talked about that before in this panel. When I think about the modern day apprenticeship, I'm also directly talking to those young people in their rooms at home who dream about building online games, mobile apps and developing software. I'm also talking to those people that don't feel supported by the system so that we can reach out to them to enable them to realise their ambitions. I genuinely believe that we are missing a trick. We could be if we focus on skills, learning and identifying the jobs of the future, be the next sort of tech or television. Our principal and most valuable resource is our people, and we can be that country that harnesses the digital economy. Mr. Speaker, all of us in this House know then in order to drive Gibraltar forward, we must be the facilitators for growth. Our businesses go into the world to create opportunity, and this is what is being done in Hong Kong, as described by the Deputy Minister yesterday and the Minister of the Financial Services. As we all know, in order for Gibraltar to succeed and thrive, it only takes a very small slice of the global economic cake. With the result of the EU referendum still fresh in our minds, we must continue, all of us, to press our links with the City of London and other important British cities outlined by Mr. Eastman. We must dominate that space, create opportunities, and best off sell business plans and make our voice heard amongst the new policy makers. I don't like Mr. Speaker to talk about survival. I like to talk about success. And therefore, when we succeed, as I'm sure we will, we will need to demonstrate that we have the people to do the skilled work necessary to meet the needs of new business and drive our economy forward. This is why, Mr. Speaker, that I am so very passionate about skills. And in the current climate, it is absolutely essential that we get skills training right. We cannot, Mr. Speaker, continue to rely on the cyclical construction industry to plug the gap. It does little in the long term to encourage the development of entrepreneurship and the learning of new skills which we should be attracting. Mr. Speaker, it is my genuinely held belief that together we can build a highly skilled and trained workforce who will go on to create better opportunities for future generations of libertarians. Political and business leaders who led the development of the financial services industry must also turn their eyes to the opportunities that exist in the digital world. And we have an obligation and responsibility to ensure that our people are the first choice for employers because they are the best qualified. Mr. Speaker, importantly, we must continue to focus on the unemployed and those persons who, for whatever reason, have turned to criminality and to get them back into work. I say to a number of people that have found it difficult to get back into work after they have been convicted, and we need to do much, much more to improve their prospects for people that want to work after turning their lives around for a well-developed education and training program within the prison service. Again, Mr. Speaker, we have debated this in question and answer, and Mr. McGibby, I know reference was made to that in relation to the speech, together with an effort which I also applaud, which is the counselling that we're running through the prison service. Neatly, Mr. Speaker, moving to justice. The last 8 years, Mr. Speaker, has seen changes in the physical infrastructure of our justice system, improvements such as the recruitment of judges, building of new courts, new prisons, and the overhaul in the way in which justice is organised at an institutional level. New laws promulgated by successive governments have improved our justice system. The criminal law has seen many changes alongside the laws relating to family and children. In the corporate commercial world, new companies, consultancies, limited liability parts of legislation have been upgraded and brought our laws up to date. Mr. Speaker, we must not rest on our laurels. More can and must be done in law reform, and in particular, the individual's interaction with the justice system must be improved. We should now pause and rightly express our pride in the fact that a libertarian is the head of the judiciary. Mr. Justice Dudley, the Chief Justice of Regard, has the respect and admiration of everyone in our community. We should also be proud of the very strong Court of Appeal, which must be the envy of the Commonwealth. We should also be proud that we have a libertarian Attorney General with the ability of Michael Rann SPC. However, we need to move forward in improving the service for the end user. The appointment of the Director of Public Prosecutions is an important step in our development. It is yet, Mr. Speaker, unclear as to whether the establishment of a DPP will require an amendment to our constitution or whether this can be achieved through the bringing of primary legislation. I know that Mr. McKibby and I had a debate on television, I think, on viewpoint relating to that specific matter, and I note the absence of that particular point in this debate. But I think at some point, Mr. Speaker, we will need to move forward quite quickly with that appointment. Whatever route, Mr. Speaker, is decided, whatever route is decided upon, we must press ahead with the decision. The Office of Criminal Prosecutions and Litigation needs, in my view, a strong, dynamic head to actively progress the caseload of the department and motivate and manage a team of committed Crown Counsel. Recent criticism by the judiciary has brought into sharp focus the need for the appointment of a Director of Public Prosecution. In relation to legal assistance, we need to move forward in reforming the system. There are, in our view, many in our community that are unable to access justice, and it is right that those who are most in need should also be able to access the system. Mr. Speaker, in last week's session of Parliament, I expressed the view that we need to encourage and support the legal profession in creating a bar pro bono unit or for the implementation unit which will complement legal assistance. And I think it is right to pause there and say that the Minister for Justice has communicated to this chamber that it is time that discussions were underway with the bar pro bono in relation to that very point. It is obviously right, Mr. Speaker, to recognise that members of the bar do, of course, do legal work. But it shouldn't, in our view, be on a formal footing and actively encouraged. I truly believe that we can lessen the burden on the legal aid and assistance funds as we take a positive step towards a vocational obligation in the profession. Many of our lawyers, if not all, have received the benefit of a generous education funding by successive government. And we are all in this house proud that we can still continue to fund postgraduate training in this way. But the commitment by our society to fully fund fully funded, extensive professional and vocational training must also mean that those receiving the benefits must also give back. I know that members of the bar in this place and outside have acted over in a pro bono capacity, and that should be applauded, but we must do more than simply encourage the professionals to take a positive step towards giving back something to the world. We must all look at ways in which we can lessen the load of the funding system in order to best direct access to those that most need it. This is how we can improve the individual's interaction and experience with the justice system. Mr. Speaker, the opposition has actively tried to persuade the government of the benefits of a combined courts and tribunal service, which we believe will improve the individual's interaction with the tribunal system and allow for a central point of confidence and administration to go to tribunals. There is a difference of opinion between the opposition and the government on this point. I would, however, invite the government to rethink. Insofar as the Criminal Evidence and Procedure Act, it may well be now time to review the operation of this important piece of legislation in order to look at ways of further streamlining the process so that justice is delivered quickly and at cost. Mr. Speaker, as for prison reform, I'm a big believer in education in prison, and we must increase the focus of education in prison so that those who do not want to change, or those who want to change their lives, can do so. Mr. Speaker, I see a number of people trapped in the cycle of criminality, and it seems to me that education is the key to unlocking this issue. I believe that we need to cast the net wider and bring education into prison, and look at ways in which the education department can actively engage with the prison service so that we can tailor more opportunities for those who have expressed a desire to learn and to change. I align myself with the comments that the Honourable Minister for Justice has made in relation to the asylum advice of the Right Honourable for Paul Kennedy. I also welcome the changes that have been set out in the Minister for Justice speech in relation to the fact that the Tenant Government Act is an extremely welcome development insofar as increasing the counselling opportunities available to those that have addiction problems in prison, and that will also be applauded. It would be remiss of me not to mention, Mr. Speaker, the work of the Honourable Mr. Proctor in relation to the reform of the Industrial Tribunal, soon to be known as the Employment Tribunal. The reform is long overdue and is very much welcome. I've had the opportunity of considering the employment regulations which will improve the management of claims within the Employment Tribunal. I know both he and his legal counsel, Mr. Farr, travels to England to look at ways in which cases can be progressed there. Therefore, I think it's right to recognise the work that he has done by him and Mr. Farr. I have communicated to the Minister my desire to work with him on this important reform, and I'll be sending him specific proposals on the bill to reform the workings of the Industrial Tribunal, which I'm sure he will receive in a positive and constructive manner. My footnote, Mr. Speaker, and Justice is that much more needs to be done to improve the citizens' interaction with the justice system, and I would hope that those members opposite would agree that there are clear opportunities for synergy and working together for the benefit of all in our community. Mr. Speaker, in relation to drugs and rehabilitation, it is of great personal satisfaction to me that both sides of this House are unwavering in their support for the state team charity. I am sure that the Chief Minister, taking the portfolio for the general election, will agree that stories of addiction, recovery, hope are moving, and they demonstrate that drugs and their abuse destroys lives and are the enemy of family life. I've had the opportunity of sitting down and talking to recovering addicts and their journey from hopelessness and loneliness to recovery and hope. This left an impression on me. Unusually for a politician, I have been left speechless by the story, life events, human tragedy, and loss, and it is right that we continue to support them in ridding our community of the toxic consequences of addiction in whatever form it takes, grip on the lives of vulnerable people. Many addicts, Mr. Speaker, who have relaxed, tell me about the triggers in our community, from social groups to the physical environment. We need to look at ways in which we redouble our efforts by further offering specialised addiction counsellors from either within the service or from outside. I am heartened by the promise made by the Chief Minister to build drug awareness and rehabilitation into Number 6, and it is only right that this subject should feature high on the political agenda. I know that he is a busy man, and recent events naturally mean that international and diplomatic affairs will dominate his focus. However, it is my hope that he will keep his promise to those that work in the drug service and the various charities but by providing them with the help and the resources they need to be effective as possible in treating addiction, preventing relapse, and providing the opportunity for those people afflicted by addiction to get back into our community so that they too can make a positive contribution to our community. We really do, Mr. Speaker, need to give very serious thought to the needs of arrest referral workers at the point at which the individual comes into contact with the criminal justice system, namely at the police station and the court. The Scottish pilot study into this area would be of enormous benefit, and I would invite the Minister for Justice to review it to see what lessons can be drawn from the conclusions to that study. In relation to education, Mr. Speaker, for too long, politicians across the political divide have considered that the building of new schools is blunting. Of course, bricks and mortar and investment into the physical environment of our education is important. But it is just as important to listen to our teachers and the teachers' unions. Listen to them and understand their concerns. The GCL and the NAF at UWC have called out for an effective and sustainable education roadmap for the next 20 years. Last year, Mr. Speaker, the Chief Minister in his budget speech quoted the World Bank President who believes that countries have invested in people's education as well as other upgrades in the infrastructure would emerge stronger in the years ahead. I couldn't agree more with that analysis. The time for investment is now, not just in education, but also in the coordination and training of skills. All of us in this House are the beneficiaries of successive government commitment to education, but we really do need to evaluate where we are and where we are heading. The government has committed and recommitted last week in Parliament to the major investment in the building of 5 new schools for our community. Mr. Speaker, it is understood that the government are undertaking significant preparatory work. We very much hope that the government will complete the building of the 5 new schools by the end of this parliamentary term. I have certainly received assurances from the Minister of Education that this will happen. There are concerns from parents and teachers about the practicalities of the building of the 5 schools and the level of disruption that will naturally bring with it. Let's watch this space. Mr. Speaker, having raised the modern apprenticeship at the general election, I firmly believe that we need to offer more than we currently provide. Those who do not wish to pursue an academic need to be provided with the opportunity of a modern apprenticeship programme, which has the same standing as higher education. We need to create a gold standard for apprenticeship programmes so that employers have the confidence in the system. Mr. Speaker, despite the general election results, I am confident that co-education and its debate is one we must change. I remain personally convinced that we should have some form of co-education at secondary level, but do understand that there is a debate on how this can be achieved. Let us have an open, unrestrained debate on co-education. At this point, Mr. Speaker, without wishing to steal the thunder from the Honourable Mr. Rayles, I would like to say a few words on the question of housing rent. It's another area that I feel quite passionate about before I joined the GSC in raising the question of new sections of government housing. At the time, I was one of the lone wolves who pressed the debate on means testing, Mr. Speaker, government housing. The government has ruled out means testing in their election report and policy paper of the 11th of November 2015 before the election, and the Chief Minister again ruled out the implementation of their means testing policy. This, in our view, Mr. Speaker, is a mistake. Those who can afford to pay more should. We must grasp the message, stop the abuse, and have the political courage and strength of conviction in dealing with the eligibility and the fair allocation of government housing. To increase rent to 49p and 60p respectively fails to deal with the real issue of abuse and fair allocation. Small increases in rent pay lip service to curbing abuse and unfairness. The measure, Mr. Speaker, does not go far enough. And I urge the government to look to the recommendations of the Open Forum and seriously consider the policy of means testing. In times of great uncertainty, the interests of this community must come first, and the government must be prepared to take tough decisions on housing. Mr. Speaker, in summary, we live in interesting, challenging, and uncertain times. In order to weather the perfect storm, we not only need an umbrella, we also need Wellington boots. We must ensure that we create the right opportunities those that can withstand bucket loads, Mr. Speaker, no doubt, but unemployed, so that we can create the provide opportunities for our young people, our unemployed and the vulnerable, so that we can thrive. This budget should be about opportunity in adversity. Let us not make it a budget of missed opportunities. It is my genuine hope that we can all work together on areas which are crucial for Gibraltar, but also subject to Mr. Speaker's long term test the robustness of each other's policies in a constructive and dignified manner. After all, that is why people have put us in this place. Thank you.
The House will now adjourn until tomorrow morning at 9:30.